Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, this is Brett, and today is February 8th, and it is my pleasure to welcome you back to School Sucks Podcast 4.0, where we will spend each month of the year 2016 exploring a singular theme. So if you are brand new, if this is the first episode of the show that you've ever heard, let me just tell you a little bit about our mission. What we are trying to do here at the School Sucks Project is expand individual liberty through self-knowledge, self-education, and self-improvement. In January, we focused on a self-improvement topic in the form of organization and productivity. This month, we transition to self-education. And I am very, very excited to welcome a brand new guest. I think you guys are going to love him. His name is Steve Patterson. His website, steve-patterson.com. His YouTube channel, and I highly recommend that you go and subscribe. Username, Steve Thought. T-H-O-U-G-H-T. And Steve is more than qualified to guide us through this month's autodidacticism theme. He was home educated himself, and as you're going to learn in the show today, that involved a great deal of self-directed study. Now, we've talked about self-teaching on the show in great detail before in past series, like a series on the Trivium or Logic Saves Lives, but this month, we are going to be looking at this subject from a series of new angles. This is uncharted territory on School Sucks Podcast, a completely fresh approach, and I'm really, really excited to have Steve on board for the entire month. From the About Me on Steve's website, I am a rationalist philosopher and author who works outside of the academic establishment. The internet is revolutionizing every industry, including the world of ideas. The future of intellectual progress belongs to independent scholars, not ivory tower professors. Yes! I believe that truth can be discovered through a deep enough understanding of anything, as every pursuit ultimately points back to philosophy. Unfortunately, our culture is stuck in an era of irrationalism, which glorifies blurry thinking and imprecise theories. My work is trying to change that. Also, and I'm really, really excited about this as well, my conversations with Steve over the course of this month will help us revisit our philosophy of liberty roots. Yes, if you're new, we are also libertarians, so buckle up for that. For the month of February, we are going to be working from a list of 5 principles for learning anything that Steve has created after more than a decade of independent study in a variety of seemingly disparate disciplines, including philosophy, economics, martial arts, chess, and music. Today's podcast is an introduction to this series, but also an introduction to Steve, his background, and his work. And I wanted to begin today with a clip from his most recent video, which is called, Why Am I Not in Academia? This is just an excerpt of that video, so please go to his YouTube channel again, username Steve Thought, and watch the whole thing. But I'm going to let it roll, and then after that, we will begin the Principles of Learning Anything Month, the second theme in School Sucks Podcast, 4.
One of the problems with the system of academia as it is now is that it very strongly rewards groupthink. Now, people phrase it more kindly in academia. They go, oh, it's peer review or it's scientific consensus, but it's really ultimately groupthink. Now, this is, theoretically, it makes sense, but also very strongly correlates with all of my experience talking with academicians. I'll give you a few examples. So I have my bachelor's degree in political science, And what I would say is, in terms of what I learned from my bachelor's degree, 95 at least percent of what I learned was wrong. So my political theory beliefs derived from my own research 100%. And what I actually learned in school was most of it was crap and nonsense. Now, within academia, and within any group of people really, there is a kind of framework of what is allowable debate and what is not allowable debate. You could even call it a framing error. So in the general public, for example, people think that the debate, the political debate, the acceptable political debate is between conservatives on one end of the spectrum, liberals on the other end of the spectrum, and then you have moderates in between them. Both ends of the spectrum share mutual assumptions that they never challenge and they never examine. So, for example, should it be the case that we should have an income tax is something that's never debated. You have liberals debate whether it should be 40% or 80%. Conservatives say it should be 30 or 20%. Pretty much nobody says should we have it in the first place. And in fact, this kind of framing error goes all the way to the very roots of government in particular. Should we have a government at all? This is not really something that's even conceivably entertained because people make a framing error. I also have discovered that in other areas of thought, you see the exact same framing errors, what I would call groupthink. The most profound of which, the most shocking of which in my own experience, is in mathematics of all areas of thought. I used to think, before examining the field, that mathematics, everybody understood, was essentially an exercise in logic. That 2 plus 2 equals 4 is not an empirical proposition that's up for, you know, putting to peer review and testing. It's something that's logically necessary. But mathematicians haven't believed that for a century. There's an essential framing argument in mainstream mathematical thinking, and they make two foundational errors. One is the kind of implicit assumption of Platonism that mathematics deals with some other universe, some other world that may or may not correlate to this world, and it's this universe of numbers, which is nonsense. And the other has to do with their conceptions of infinity. The concept of infinity in set theory and in other areas of mathematics is absolutely foundational to the way that they approach their system of knowledge, and yet it's fundamentally flawed. This is not just true in mathematics or political theory. It's also true in economics and every other field that I've independently studied. The mainstream consensus makes a fundamental framing error, and it just so happens that the system of academia, the very way in which things operate, does not allow much challenge at all for debating these framing arguments. There's a reason why 99% plus of professional mathematicians make the same error. It's because if you disagree, as I do, with the treatment and conception of infinity in mathematics, you are going to be rejected from the mathematical establishment. I could not get a job in some university somewhere because I would not teach my students errors in ways of thinking about infinity. And so you get this natural gravitational weight of people who already agree with each other all forming into this little establishment, where then it gets even more perverted because these people think, oh, well, all of the experts agree on the foundations, therefore the foundations must be true. There's not really a way to challenge them because if you write something that's radically against, that goes against the foundations, they can say, oh, what are you talking about? You're a crank. You don't understand. For the past century, this is the way that economics has been done. And from my perspective, because I am free and outside of academia, I can freely criticize and say, no, this is a bunch of crap, this is a bunch of crap, and I don't have to worry about getting published. I don't have to worry about appealing to my peers. I don't have to worry about dumbing down my argument or murkying up my argument because it reads more like academic jargon. So this also correlates very strongly with my personal experiences, not just in terms of being able to theoretically understand why academia is kind of systemically flawed. Academicians are some of the most self-righteous people you're ever going to meet because they are absolutely convinced of their own brilliance. Not only internally, but also externally. They have credentialing, right? Somebody, they look down, they see badges on their chest, and they go, wow, I'm a really big deal. What I say must be really smart. All of my peers agree with me, and they all have badges on their chest. It's very similar, if not identical, to what you would see in something like a theological seminary or a group of pastors getting together who all share the exact same assumptions, patting themselves on the back and saying, oh gosh, good job publishing your paper about the existence of this many angels that are on the head of a pin. Oh, good job, Bob. Oh yes, Bob is an excellent person. Oh yes, Jim is an excellent person. It's like, that's great, it's very insular, but I don't want anything to do with it.
Steve Patterson, welcome to School Sucks Podcast.
Thanks, great to be here.
So you have a website, steve-patterson.com, and you also have a YouTube channel called, your username is Steve Thought. And you frequently talk on this channel about the mission of creating a more rational worldview. And, you know, from what I see in many places on the internet and certainly on the television, that sounds pretty ambitious.
Well, so it's not just YouTube. I've only been doing YouTube frequently for about the last 6 months or so, but I've been writing about philosophy as my main interest for a little bit over a year now, almost full time.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider myself a philosopher working outside of academia. I had a fairly lackluster experience in academia. Maybe we can talk about
that. I love that.
So for the past several years, I've been doing a lot of writing and video production professionally. So I've been working in the nonprofit world. Actually, I was listening to some of your podcasts yesterday, and I noticed that Fee is sponsoring your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to do work. I still do some work with Fee. I don't know if you've seen their Truth About animation series.
Yeah, I actually have seen some of those.
Yeah, those are all my creation. Very proud of them. Hopefully there will be more in the future. We'll see. So I've been involved in the world of ideas for several years, but I just am not convinced that the future of intellectual progress is in academia, so I'm trying to kind of go it my own way. So I'm writing, I'm in the process of my second book, and like you mentioned, I'm doing YouTube every week now.
Awesome. So we're going to come back to that, to the academia portion of that, but let's go way back first and talk a little bit about your background leading up to how you got into this world of ideas. Can we start just by talking about your actual education, first as a youngster and then as a college-aged person?
Certainly. So I kind of have a unique story. I was homeschooled from beginning to end.
Nice.
In terms of my pre-college education. I was the only one in my family that did it my entire upbringing. Some of my siblings were homeschooled for shorter parts of their academic career. But that was really very important to me. I wouldn't have changed that experience for the world because it really instilled a love of learning and an interest in autodidacticism and teaching myself things.
Mm-hmm.
When I was about 10 or so, my mom was diagnosed with cancer for the first time, and she was the chemo was really hard on her, and so she pretty much told me, look, this is the material you have to get done. Here are the textbooks. Here are the videos. You got to kind of teach yourself.
Mm.
And so I did. And in that a discovery process, not only did I learn a lot of information, but I also kind of learned how to learn. So I loved my homeschool upbringing. I was able to do a lot of really cool extracurricular stuff growing up. And I started going to college when I was 16, and I graduated with my BA when I was 20. I have a degree in political science, but 95% of what I learned was a bunch of crap. So my political science education is also self-studied, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners can say.
Indeed. Yeah, you know, I was even thinking, like, people might be nervous when I say, yes, we have a political science graduate on the show, and he's going to be working with me all month. So rest assured, I want to let everybody know we are coming from very, very similar places philosophically, which we're also going to talk about. It was actually one of my listeners that originally suggested you to me as a guest. So you're in, after this home education experience, which had for many years, from what you've described, a kind of unschool feel to it, right? Where even though there's some basic guidelines for you, you're really going your own way and running your own tests on what you're doing to see what works and to see what doesn't, right?
Well, it's funny you say that because it didn't start out that way. Mm. My mother really did not want to homeschool. She, at the time, actually, a cool story, she was a kind of first generation homeschoolers in New York. It wasn't even clear when she started homeschooling whether or not it was legal.
Right. That was my next question.
Yeah. True story. And I guess you could say we're like 1.5 generation because some of our friends, I think they were called the Black Welders or something like that. They were involved in like the first legal case in New York determining whether or not homeschooling was going to be legal or illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, she really didn't want to do homeschooling, but she was very religious and she felt very compelled. I don't like what I've been taught, what my kids are being taught in public school. I don't know how it's going to work, but I just got to start homeschooling. So when we originally started, she wanted to make it like school, except in the home. So, you know, we had a little classroom area. We had each of us had our own little desks, you know, and we had a lot of times that we would go over certain topics, essentially like it was schooling just in the house. But that didn't last too long. I don't know if it was because we were unruly kids or if it wasn't working, but eventually the longer we got into the education, the more unschooling-like it became to where I'm the youngest in my family, and probably from, I don't know, what it would be considered like eighth grade or something, I was pretty much on my own entirely, which was super valuable. And one of my brothers is also kind of a self-studied intellectual, and he also credits homeschooling as a big part of his own kind of grounding and intellectual independence.
Interesting. You know, I'm curious, how did your mother explain her aversion to public school to you when you were very young? And I also wonder, because you are the youngest, you have older siblings who might have had some similar experiences, what kind of attitudes did you form due to their influence about the public school system versus what you were doing?
That's a good question. So for me, because it was all the way from the beginning, I've been learning in the home since the day I was born. So it wasn't too radical for me I didn't really have anything to contrast it to. But some of my siblings were taken out of school, and I think the reaction was mixed. I know one of my brothers, for example, eventually went back to school for his last maybe 2 years or so of high school, just because he was kind of a rebellious guy, and he wanted the social experience of being around all of his peers, and he didn't feel like he was getting that enough in being homeschooled. But it's funny, because in the homeschool community, especially at that time, there was, as I suppose you would also have in any community of kids, there was this very in-group, out-group dynamic, where you had the homeschoolers and then you had the public schoolers that were kind of a rowdy bunch that were, it sounds presumptuous, but it was true, they're always farther behind in terms of what curriculum the homeschool community was learning, because homeschoolers tend to learn at a very rapid pace because they can go at their own pace. You know, they're not bound by teachers who have to teach to the middle. They kind of progress however fast that is, and a lot of times that's very fast. So we did have kind of a weird relationship with the public school kids. And it's funny, too, because we used to get all kinds of criticism all the time. People would say, oh, homeschoolers, you guys don't see the sun. You're stuck indoors all day. You have no social skills. That's not the case at all. I think the reason why most homeschoolers might seem a little bit socially awkward around regular public school peer groups is because homeschoolers tend to be way more mature. Quite frankly, because we're around adults, or we were around adults so much more, natural obnoxious childlike behavior was naturally obnoxious to a lot of homeschoolers too. So
yeah,
I know a lot of like my peers growing up felt more comfortable interacting with like, you know, adults than we did your regular kids as they were going through public school.
Absolutely. So the other thing too is that the school environment creates that kind of behavior, you know, and it's, if you think about the ratio of young people to adults, whether it's elementary school or even middle school, there's somebody like controlling a bunch of kids essentially, but there aren't like mentor relationships, you know? And when you're outside of that environment and you're much more likely to interact with adults one-on-one, John Taylor Gatto talks a lot about the importance of these kind of interactions. It has a real maturing effect. And I think the other thing about, you know, learning more rapidly, because I noticed that working with a lot of students who were outside of the traditional schooling model, they also are able to respond to their own interests, to be driven by their own interests. Yeah, if math is something that you like, you can learn it very, very rapidly, because you don't have to really listen to anyone else talk to you about it or set a pace for you. And you don't have to shut the book and stuff it into a 50-pound backpack when a bell rings. So there's lots of great advantages. We've explored those pretty thoroughly on the show in the past. And I appreciate you having that experience. I think it'll make for some interesting conversations this month. But now that we're done with primary school and secondary school. We move on to college. What a magical place to study political science. Did you go into that experience with any preconceived political ideas? Did you? I know I remember being kind of indifferent and somewhat apathetic before discovering history when I was in college, and then immediately being pushed very, very far to the left. What was your experience like?
So another great question. The way that it worked, the way I kind of got drawn into college is when I was 16, the place that I was living in New York, there was a local college. It was called Alfred University, and it's in upstate New York. It's like a liberal arts college. They had a program where high school juniors and seniors, I think it was, they could take some classes for like $100 a class or something like that at the university, which was just a fraction of how expensive it would be if you were there full time. And so I started going when I was still, I hadn't technically graduated from homeschooling because there's not really, you don't really have a ceremony or anything like that, or there's no formal process in when you graduate, at least at the time from homeschooling. And so I started taking, I think the first classes I took were something like in physics, and I think French it was.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, this is cool. This is going to supplement, you know, other things that I'm doing. But I didn't really take it very seriously. I got, you know, B's, B minuses, didn't really care. And then I think when I was about 18, I had a girlfriend at the time that came to Alfred University, and she was a straight A student. She was also homeschooled, but like obsessively straight A. She graduated with like a 4.0 or a 3.9, whatever, summa cum laude, like super passionate student. And it was the first time I thought, gosh, that seems like a good idea. Why don't I try to get straight A's? It just never dawned on me. Didn't really care about it.
Right.
At the time, I was thinking it was like I was going into the martial arts or something like that. I just didn't really cross my mind. But so I was there. I had already taken, I had several classes under my belt from their program. And so when I started going full time, I was like, well, what do I want to study? And I think actually my brother at the time was interested in political science. And we'd always talked about like politics around the dinner table in my family. I was like, well, I guess I'll just, you know, I'll take some classes. We'll see what happens. But to specifically answer your question, I certainly did have a lot of strong political beliefs going into it. Just from my upbringing in this kind of conservative Christian community that I was raised in. Mm-hmm. And so I went, and naturally what I found was the exact opposite. It was all these extreme leftists with all these ideas. And I thought, oh, this is terrible. And then eventually that's just what I wound up doing. And I don't hold the conservative Christian ideas anymore. I've moved much more into like radical libertarian ideas. But I certainly went in thinking, oh, I'm going to teach these leftists something.
Yeah, and how did that go?
To put it nicely, I learned some things in college. But what I learned was not what they wanted to teach me. I learned how to interact with people who I would not consider critical thinkers. I learned how to put up with hours upon hours of nonsensical academic regurgitation. I learned all kinds of weird and inapplicable skills to the real world about how to navigate in an atmosphere of intellectual shallowness, you might say. None of these things, of course, as you can imagine, the professors and my peers, I was never exactly the class darling.
right.
But yeah, so I certainly learned some things. I put it this way. I was driven even more intensely into my own research about political theory and about economics as a function of the nonsense I was taught in college. So in a sense, it really developed me into who I am today. I would say I'm very competent in my understanding of political theory and philosophy and economics, largely because of the underwhelming experience that I had in college.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that's where there's some divergence between our two experiences. I went into college very much a blank slate. Now, both my parents are conservative. I was raised in kind of an apathetically religious household where, you know, the attitude was, well, you know, Jesus is a good message, so we'll go to church and maybe you'll do the Catholic things. And I did it, and then my brothers didn't have to because my parents didn't think it had a tremendously positive impact on me for the, you know, the time investment and all of that. But, you know, my schooling experience made me very apathetic, and without that strong religious foundation. I'm not, certainly not saying that that's needed, but I didn't go into college with my defenses up. Certainly not my intellectual self-defenses, because my prior schooling experience hadn't really helped me build those things. Mm. You know, I was just going through the motions, and when I got to college, it was the 13th grade, and there was, you know, 4 years of that, and there'd be great jobs waiting on the other side of it. So it's interesting. It's like it seems like you went into that situation with a more defensive posture, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely true. And then around that time when I was going to college was when Ron Paul's first presidential campaign came around in 2007, 2008. Mm-hmm. And then that was kind of a game changer for me, really, honestly, in terms of the course of my life, because I was on YouTube and I somehow stumbled across a video of Ron talking about monetary economics, I think it was. I was like, who is this old guy that is saying all these things I've never heard before? Everybody's kind of laughing at him, but gosh, he makes a lot of sense. And so I started listening to him, and I was like, oh, this, there's something serious here. And then he would occasionally drop terms like Austrian economics. And what the heck is that? So eventually I Googled it, and then I went down the rabbit hole of Austrian economics. And then, right, I wound up as like a bleeding heart anarchist, like 100% against the typical conclusions of mainstream economics.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But around that time, it wasn't so much, oh, I'm defending myself against the academicians and the students. It's more like I kind of need to help them out, or like enlighten them, or like there's all these ideas that I can guarantee nobody's even heard of, much less rigorously tried to grapple with. Like I thought and still think the truth is out there in regards to all sorts of different topics, philosophy in particular. The truth is out there. It's really important, and we really should talk about it. So part of what was so just I kind of took out a lot of my passion for academia is that not only would people make bad counterarguments, they weren't even interested in ideas. It's like they're here, like you were saying, they're going through the motions. And it's like, well, of all the places to go through the motions, it would seem like the university system would not be the best place. Right? That's the place where you're supposed to grapple with these big ideas. And that kind of romantic intellectual discussion just never materialized from the students or the professors.
Yeah, and it never even occurred to me when I was there, you know, studying history and political science a little bit. It's just like what I had learned was the person at the front of the class knew. I didn't know. I was paying a whole bunch of money to be there to find out. And that was our relationship. And the teacher that I had in college, I give him a lot of credit. And he was very, very Socratic in his approach. So it wasn't his fault. But then you can contrast that with the stories that I hear from other places, professors in economics, political science, philosophy, environmental science. Mm. These are not environments that welcome debate. And people get, you know, I had college students calling into a call-in show we were doing a couple years ago, and people sending me emails about how questions can result in like a scolding from professors and peers as a kind of reinforcement. So you probably have some sense of what I'm talking about from your experience.
100%. Yeah, and the university that I went to, Alfred University, is very left anyway. Mm. Of all the, I mean, academia is very heavily bent left, and Alfred is kind of on the more extreme end of that spectrum.
Sure.
So, I'll give you an example. We were in a class once on, it was like race and legal theory. And I put forward the idea, not defending or not defending, just put forward the idea that maybe the history of affirmative action is not as illustrious as people make that to be. Maybe it's not even a good idea. And I remember there was a black student in class who literally got up. She was like pointing at me and super upset. She said, "You are such a racist." And she turned it and asked the professor that he like scolded and condemned me, calling me a racist for entertaining the idea that affirmative action was not necessarily a great idea. I mean, that's the kind of a silence that was expected of you as you were shot these ideas.
And things have not improved in the last 7 or 8 years at all.
It's funny you say that because there's two things here. One, I get a lot of things coming up in my news feed because I'm part of like the anti-academic community. I get so many things that come up that are almost self-parodies of themselves, like the people who are freaking out, for example, like in the broader political correctness narrative that is in our culture, like the yoga teacher that was in, I think it was Ottawa, Canada, that was like teaching yoga for free to disabled students, but she was white, and somebody freaked out because she wasn't the appropriate race to teach the yoga class to disabled students, and she was shut down. Like, if I were making a parody of these kind of politically correct left ideas, that would be what I would come up with, and yet that's the truth. But the second part of that is my own work now is explicitly like outside of academia. I am trying, you and me both, are in the very front end of what I would call like the decentralization of knowledge. Mm. The university system has served an important function, historically speaking, because it centralized knowledge into one place. You could go, there would be libraries at universities, you could talk with fellow intellectuals about ideas. That's an essential role for the kind of the progression of intellectual progress. Now, with the internet, we have the centralization of knowledge and the decentralization of knowledge. So, because you can access the biggest library ever, which is the internet, but you don't have to physically be there. You can access it online. You type in some things, hit enter, and then you know you're reading works that were written 600 years ago. I mean, it's incredible, right? You can type up an email to virtually anybody in the world and exchange ideas with them. And I think that is so efficient and so superior to the kind of entrenched bureaucratic academic system that we have that I, you know, 20 years in the future, I foresee a radically different world of kind of self-studied internet intellectuals that are going to kind of surpass the traditional establishment academic system. And that's what I'm explicitly trying to do. I know that's what you're trying to do. That's what I'm explicitly trying to do about philosophy. That's my main passion, is the world of ideas. I think as the more you abstract in different areas of thought, the more you get sucked into philosophy, the really important ideas, and academicians are miserable philosophers, if I can be.
Mm.
The vast majority of philosophy that's out there that comes out of the academic establishment is bunk. It gets the foundations wrong, and that's what I'm trying to correct.
Well, the people who work in academia, by and large, like Paul Krugman comes to mind, that's a very, very comfortable, safe, and secure kind of life, you know? So now it's interesting that what we've seen, and I really only started paying attention to what you were describing as far as like somebody basically standing up in a class and telling you to shut up and condemning you for presenting an idea. I've really only started to pay attention to that in the last year. I saw the movie PCU in 1994. But it didn't make any sense to me then, you know, and it really wasn't until the escalation of, you know, the events at Mizzou and Yale and Dartmouth and, you know, a couple other schools that I really started to, because we've railed against the higher education scam on my show for a while, what is increasingly becoming a scam for quite some time. And I perked up and said, okay, this is something that I need to start paying attention to. So the people who fill the roles of professors have always had this very comfortable existence. You and I know that there are so many wonderful rewards for breaking out of comfort zones. And I'm really just starting to realize this. I can get into a real comfort zone, believe me. But what lies beyond that can be incredibly fulfilling, enriching, educational experiences. But there's no guarantee of security. And there's no guarantee of cash flow, and there's no guarantee of prestige. And academia pretty much guarantees all those things to people who like comfort zones, like Paul Krugman. And I mean, we could generate a whole list of people like that. We're seeing it actually now translate intellectually. I'm not saying that the professor's love of the comfort zone is causing this, but we're definitely seeing it, that there's like this institutionalization of comfort zone around the issue of political correctness. I want a safe space that is impermeable when it comes to ideas that upset me. So yes, we are very, very much beyond that. And I would continue on by, you know, you had your worldview, your political philosophy rocked significantly 7 or 8 years ago with the emergence of Ron Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big spark for me too, at exactly the same time. But as you began to study philosophy more deeply and political science or political philosophy more deeply, who were your major influences? What really took the Ron Paul embrace to the next level for you?
So there were several conversations that I had, books that I had read that kind of pushed me over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one, it would be hard to overstate the impact of Ron Paul, because at the time, YouTube was still kind of relatively new at the time, the first Ron Paul boom. And there was still a lot of videos of his speeches out there. And then, like, the Mises Institute, he used to talk, I think he mentioned the Mises Institute once. The Mises Institute had and still has a ton of online lectures explaining Austrian economics totally for free on YouTube. So just utilizing YouTube to be exposed to these ideas that I had never heard before was immensely influential. But it didn't take me very long to go from conservative to very libertarian to minarchist to anarchist. And where I got hung the longest was that jump from minarchism to anarchism.
Sure, yeah.
And there was so one of the books that was very influential was Chaos Theory by Bob Murphy, which is a short book which explains kind of how criminal law and civil law would work in a non-monopolized society. And I found the part on civil law completely compelling. Like, how would contracts work without a government? Boom, got it. Okay, yes. But I wasn't convinced by the criminal law. And so I actually got the opportunity to go to Mises University one year. I think it was 2009, maybe, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue with everybody there, because there's a very high ratio of anarchists at Mises University. I said, oh, I'm not convinced. And I remember going there and I was learning about economics and the reasoning behind this radical libertarianism. And I was like, okay, well, I'm somewhere between minarchism and anarchism. I'm going to call myself a secessionist. And I did that for, I don't know, a few days. And my idea was something along the lines of, well, you know, in theory, anarchism sounds great, but practically it wouldn't work, right? If one guy is in the middle of a city and he says, I am independent, practically speaking, it doesn't really, right? Other people can, you know, kill him or put him in jail. It just wouldn't work. That was my short-term objection. But I actually had a conversation with a friend named Dan that I met there, who was a former Air Force guy turned anarchist, super sweet guy. And we were talking at one of the bars one of the nights, and he said, okay. He said, I understand what you're saying, Steve, and you're making some good objections, but let me ask you this. He said, if I want to opt out of any particular good that the government is providing me with, if I want to opt out of it, should I be able to? And I thought about it, and I was like, well, I mean, on the one hand, of course, if you don't want to use a particular good or service for whatever reason, you shouldn't have to pay for it. That doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
And I thought, well, if that's the case, then that's essentially what these anarchists are talking about. That's like a voluntary government, which isn't a government at all, by definition.
Right.
So I remember that night, I was like, dang, Dan, I think I'm an anarchist. And I was like, no, I was like a closet anarchist. So the next couple of months, I was internally debating with myself, is this true? Is this true? And eventually, I would play devil's advocate with myself enough where I started being convinced by the devil's advocate in my head. So I was arguing as an anarchist would.
Right.
And eventually, I was like, damn, that's a good point. So I eventually turned into a radical libertarian anarchist in a matter of a couple of years. And now it's so clear. I mean, I couldn't conceive of going back. That once you make that first step, the way that you see the world and the explanation for the phenomena that you experience in terms of understanding politics and economics and how it all comes together is just overwhelming. It's just totally, completely overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah, it was a slow process for me as well, and there was a real reluctance, and it was kind of like, what do I tell people? How do I explain myself to others? It started with a book. I listened to it. You're familiar with Free Talk Live? Yeah, so I discovered that coming out of like a real kind of conspiratorial mindset. From there, I got to a show called Complete Liberty, hosted by a guy named Wes Bertrand. From there, I found For a New Liberty and read that.
Naturally, yeah.
That pumped me up. And then I reached out to Wes Bertrand. We met. He turned me on to Free Domain Radio. And that was like, I don't know, sometime in 2008. And there was really no going back at that point. And I fully accept. And I think Steph and his communication style and his arguments really helped me embrace it. I was very comfortable with that. Maybe even as I've talked about some of the communication problems that I've had in the past, maybe even a little too comfortable, maybe even a little too self-assured. you know, and a little belligerent at times. But that's actually something that we're going to be discussing this month. And we've spent this time going through your educational background and your philosophical background a little bit. What we're going to try and do in February on School Sucks is make your autodidacticism useful to thousands of people. And when I was first told about your work, I watched one of your videos called The Principles of Learning Anything. And I said, that's a great title. I'm excited to see what this is. And you had a list of five principles. And we always look for new ways to think about self-teaching, to think about the critical thinking processes and self-monitoring processes along the way. So I was very, very interested to give this list, I think, a fuller, more expansive treatment, which is what we're introducing today. So we are going to just preview each one of the principles before we wrap up this session. But I wanted to ask how you actually developed this list.
Sure. So like I said before, growing up homeschooled, mm-hmm. I was able to do a lot of extracurricular work. It wasn't just math and science. It was also I was involved in the school plays and the basketball, and I did the martial arts, and I was involved in table tennis and learning how to play chess at a really high level. And I did a ton of extracurricular stuff, which I loved. I loved a lot more than the academic work.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered was there's a commonality that you see when you're trying to learn anything. It doesn't matter what it is. You discover these abstract principles of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And those abstract principles apply to every other thing that you're trying to learn. And this is even true in the world of ideas. It blends even like a physical skill. So let's say, for example, you're trying to learn how to play the piano, which is something that I've spent a lot of time trying to do. The principles you learn and you discover when you're trying to do something like play the piano are the same principles when you're trying to learn economics. And it sounds very weird and woo-woo and mystical, but it's not at all. And this is something that I've read only one other person really write about, and his name is Josh Whiteskin. And he is a former chess national champion, and he also does martial arts, which is something that I've been involved in for a long time. And he also sees that there are these kind of abstract principles at play, but outside of that, for some reason, I don't see a lot of people talking about it. And I think it's probably because people get so specialized, they don't try to learn a bunch of other things, and they're very focused on the concrete. But I'm really excited about the abstract. So my experience growing up and trying to learn a bunch of different things helped me see that. And then I've chosen from there, I don't know, maybe a dozen different disciplines or areas of thought that I've really tried to master with good success. And I've really focused a lot of energy on those, and I credit a lot of that, if not all of it, to just a simple understanding of these principles. And I'll just list them, and then we can talk about them more if you want. Number one, I guess, is kind of the umbrella term for some of the other ones. There's five of them, and they all blend together with one another.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the principle of technique. The second one is the principle of efficiency. The third one is the principle of mastering the basics. The fourth is kind of about the process of learning itself, and it's the principle of doubt. And then the last one is the principle of embracing your own incompetence and understanding the role of failure in the learning process. So those are the five, and you can literally, so far, every area of thought or discipline I've tried to study, you can literally take this list and think, okay, I'm going to try to find where these abstract principles apply, and you'll probably be able to do it.
So for the people in my audience who are brand new to this idea, let's just do a demonstration where maybe we make, in your mind, a valuable connection between something like chess and martial arts.
Yeah.
And you can pick the example.
Yeah, so that, honestly, those are two of my favorite. And as we talk about these, I'll probably go back to both chess and the martial arts many times.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with, let's say, the principle of technique in the martial arts. An excellent illustration of this is the history of what's called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is a discipline, a martial art that I'm studying right now. I've studied Kenpo Karate. I have a black belt in Kenpo Karate. I have a black belt in Hakaru Jiu-Jitsu, which is a Japanese Jiu-Jitsu. And I'm training now, right now, in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And what you find in the martial arts world is there are tens of thousands of people, and perhaps hundreds of thousands around the globe, who think that they have mastered the art of self-defense because they are, you know, black belts in karate, for example, or they're black belts in Muay Thai, or they've been training 20 years in this one particular style of judo, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they think, as a function of that, they're very knowledgeable about self-defense. What you discover is, empirically speaking, that's not actually the case. The technique that they focused on is not actually the objectively best technique for learning what you're trying to learn. If you're trying to learn self-defense techniques, then I would recommend not learning Aikido. Now, that's a very controversial statement, but it's one of the reasons that the martial arts is such a fantastic world to analyze is because you have empirical demonstration. It's one thing for an Aikido practitioner to say, oh, I could defend myself in such or such a circumstance, and a Brazilian jiu-jitsu person to say, no, I could defend it, and you're doing it wrong. And if it's just words, there's no way to evaluate whether or not one's true and one's false. Well, in the world of martial arts, you can fight.
Right.
And you can demonstrate objective superiority. And what happened is in the first part of the 20th century, there was a Brazilian guy named Hélio Gracie who learned some styles of jiu-jitsu, modified the techniques of jiu-jitsu because he was kind of a frail guy. He wasn't a big guy. And he refined the techniques to be extremely precise and efficient, which we can talk about. And he put his style to the test around the globe. He was like, look, regardless of where you are, whatever style you're training, come to Brazil, we'll fight, and we'll see which technique is the best. And for like decades, this guy was kicking everybody's ass. And I would say, honestly, in the history of the martial arts, Hélio Gracie is one of, if not the most pivotal figures in the entire history, the thousands of years that the martial arts have been around. Mm-hmm. It was that revolutionary. So in the world of mixed martial arts, for example, everybody knows Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. If you don't have a basis in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, at least understanding the basic concepts, you're going to lose 100% of the time. You cannot live, you cannot be a professional as a mixed martial artist where punches and kicks and grappling techniques are allowed without a basis in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And that's entirely a function of the technique. The techniques are objectively superior. So, now, another example we would say in chess. What differentiates an excellent chess player from a novice or from an intermediate is the actual technique of their chess. It is the method in which they accomplish their goals. It is getting from point A to point B. And if you don't do that right, there's lots of wrong ways to play chess, then you're not going to be a good chess player. And again, this seems very abstract, like, oh, do the right thing.
Right, right.
But what you discover is in lots of different fields of thought, there are mutually exclusive claims on what is the correct technique. You see it all the time in the world of ideas and philosophy, especially. People have their reasoning process, their technique for evaluating the accuracy of ideas can be really good and really accurate, or it can be catastrophically flawed.
Right.
And
yeah.
If you're working with the wrong technique, then you're not going to be able to master philosophy or even understand it to a basic degree.
Indeed. So what we're going to aim to do in these five principles or through these five principles is not just, you know, abstract, but also talk about a kind of awareness and attunement to each one, right? So we're going to talk about how paying attention to technique is important across a variety of disciplines and the same things with the others. I wanted to give you just an opportunity. You mentioned the other four, but just maybe like a preview, a line or two about each one.
Okay, so number two is the principle of efficiency. And it's almost a derivative principle of the principle of technique. And it's essentially accomplishing your goals, getting from A to B, while using the least amount of energy. Mm-hmm. Or doing it the most efficient way, going a very direct route from A to B, not an indirect route. And just a couple of examples, right? We'll just go back to the chess and martial arts again. In chess, if you have a goal on the chessboard, you want to accomplish something, but it takes you 10 moves to get there, and the other opponent is able to accomplish their goals in 2 moves, the other person is going to beat you.
Right.
Or in the martial arts, if there's kind of 2 ways you can look at efficiency. One is in conservation of your own physical energy, because when you're fighting, your energy level drains very quickly. If somebody can make you run out of energy, they're going to beat you up because you won't be able to defend yourself. And 2, the actual efficiency of how you move your limbs. So if two people are trying to race to one point, you know, somebody wants to get their leg here, it's either the leg goes there or the arm goes there. Whoever gets there is going to be in a better position, and it depends on how efficient their technique is to get to there. If one person is moving their arm like this in a really wild way, you know, and the other person is moving very straightforward and very linear, that person's going to have a more efficient technique. Okay, so the third one is equally as important as the others, and it's the principle of mastering the basics. This I get so excited about. So you're gonna have to rein me in if I monologue too much.
No problem.
So the principle of the basics, you see this incredible phenomenon when you study excellent performers, or you study people who have demonstrated a high degree of competence. That what they're doing is essentially performing the basic textbook techniques of whatever they're trying to do at a very high level. My favorite example is Roger Federer, whom I consider to be the probably the best tennis player ever, is Roger Federer.
Yes, sure.
You watch him play, and it's not like he's doing cartwheels and backflips on the tennis court. He's not doing all these wild and crazy things. It's just the basics to this incredible degree. And it's also efficiency and relaxation. It's his technique. But the reason he has this masterful technique is because his basics are so extraordinarily good. And in the world of ideas, too, if you get the basics wrong, right? So let's say you want to learn about economics. And there are basic concepts you must learn in economics if you're going to understand economics. You have to learn about supply and demand. You have to learn about the structure of production, the role of prices, profits, and losses. You have to understand, you know, what the effects of the minimum wage and intervention is on the economy. You have to know these things. And if you don't, you don't understand economics. And so what I would say is understanding economics is almost identical with understanding the basics of economics. And people overlook the basics all the time. I can't wait to talk about that one in more detail. So
yeah, we definitely, you know, I think this one's really important because we live in a world of shortcuts today. And in the world of ideas, that can be very, very dangerous. And I've certainly, you know, been guilty of that myself a few times. You know, there's a lot of things that I want to absorb and at least understand. But we're talking more here, I think, about mastery. Right.
Yes.
So maybe there's places we're moving towards mastery. Right. Like there's places where if you're just looking for a surface understanding of something, maybe there's some shortcuts that are appropriate. But in this case, and I think in that field, really, really having a grasp of the fundamentals is essential for being able to move forward and being useful with those ideas as far as anyone else is concerned.
I agree with most of that. What I would say is I don't think there is a shortcut to understanding outside of the basics. The basics are a shortcut. So if you want to cut through a lot of the nonsense that Paul Krugman is writing about, just understand the basics and you can see through it.
I don't. Right.
And what I would say is, too, if you think that there is a shortcut to understanding while not understanding the basics, that's confusion. You might have illusory understanding, but you're not going to actually understand the topic unless it's an understanding of the basics, is what I would say.
Excellent. Okay. And then we move on to a kind of skepticism, right?
Yes. So these last two principles are kind of about the process of learning itself. The fourth one is called the principle of doubt. And essentially, it's a friendly social proposition and essentially says, assume that most people don't know what they're talking about at any given point. You have to doubt everybody that you are learning from. You have to doubt yourself. There has to be a lens of assuming that people don't understand the basics and they're probably wrong about what they're talking about. Now, if you have that mindset, then you're not going to be set up for trying to understand something without learning the basics. I'll give you an example. In mathematics, there's a lot of mathematicians out there who are really proficient at being able to calculate. Right? They know how to manipulate numbers in such a way where they can make impressive calculations. Not a lot of professional mathematicians out there take the time to examine the basics of mathematics, like the metaphysics of mathematics. What are numbers in the first place? If you are a mathematician and you don't have a conception of what numbers are or how they relate to reality, if they do relate to reality, that I would say is not an actual understanding of mathematics. You might have an understanding of calculation. You don't understand mathematics if you don't understand kind of the basics of what you're talking about. And what you find is a huge amount of people out there in the martial arts, in chess, in philosophy, in every area of thought, people don't really grasp what they're talking about. And so you shouldn't just have faith that they do and try to repeat what they tell you. So that is what I found essential. It's not exactly friendly, and people don't like when you kind of assume they don't know what they're talking about. But in terms of mastering something, I think it's kind of essential. And that, it blends into the last principle, which is arguably as important as any of the other principles, and it is embracing your own incompetence. It has to do with ego. What I would say, honestly, one of, if not the, biggest roadblocks to people understanding whatever they're trying to understand, learn whatever they're trying to learn, master whatever skill they're trying to master, is ego. Everybody deals with it. I deal with it. It's an ongoing thing you have to be aware of. But a big ego, is a methodological error, meaning in every single time when you're trying to do something, every single time you're trying to learn something, every single move you're making on the chessboard, if you have ego and you're trying to show how smart you are, how good you are at this, you're trying to execute to impress people, you are going to make a exponentially more amount of error, an exponentially larger amount of errors. And you're not going to understand. Ego and understanding are these mutually exclusive things. If you get part of understanding is understanding, gosh, all these things I used to think were true aren't true anymore, and I understand them for such and such a reason. If you can't get to the point where you're admitting that you just don't know what you're talking about, then you're never going to really get to that point of true understanding. And this, and just personally speaking, like growing up, 99% of the ideas I used to hold about philosophy were wrong. Now, I could have spent my career trying to defend them and say, no, I was right all along, no, and whatever. My understanding of philosophy wouldn't get off of square one if that were the case. Instead, I've discovered, gosh, almost everything I believed about the world was wrong, but I understand why. I've gotten to a new degree of understanding entirely because I've realized, damn, I just don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I think the interference of ego or the unwillingness to confront that can also be very damaging for credibility. You know, I'm very open about the fact that I am a kind of public learner, and I know some things. You know, I have a decade of experience working in and around the schools and doing self-study of history and a variety of other topics. But, you know, I'm here to learn as much as possible, and yes, I'm making that a kind of public pursuit. Once I got beyond the things about school that I knew 6 years ago, like, here's why it sucks. Okay, what is education? How do we do it? How can I do more of it? And that's what I've been doing ever since then. And sometimes, like, in a platform like this, it can be easy to forget that or overlook that I am very much a learner too. So I like the fact that that is on there and that failure is a part of it. Failure can be very, very terrifying, especially in a public forum. That was a big theme of last month when we were talking about, you know, goals and visions and entrepreneurship. So I think that that's a really, really important one as well that I look forward to discussing. Our format here is that we're going to try to devote 30 to 40 minutes to each one of these in this kind of discussion format. We also have a fairly large and fairly engaged Facebook group. So I will look forward to hearing what their feedback is for this initial discussion, and then we can take it from there. But I have a feeling that this is going to be a very, very valuable and educational month, and I look forward to all of my audience getting to know you better. So I, first of all, want to thank you for your time and wisdom and the dedication to this project. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks. And thanks to you as well. I'm super excited that I get to share these ideas with a bigger audience. I'm super passionate about it, and I really appreciate the chance.
And can you just give your website and your YouTube channel one more time for the people who are watching or listening to this?
Sure. So I have a website, steve-patterson.com, and then my YouTube channel is youtube.com/stevethought.
And what's your most recent addition to, let's say, the YouTube channel?
Well, it's actually today, interestingly enough. I haven't posted it yet, but I will. It's about why I'm not in academia. It's actually a little monologue about that, because I get asked that all the time. People assume a lot of times I'm in academia, and it's like, no, kind of an anti-academic, and it's because I think there are systemic flaws in academia, and that's what I'm talking about.
Awesome. I look forward to checking that out. All right, so we will talk again soon. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks, Brett.
New subscriber, geography, trivia, you just say a person's name. neat little fact about where they live.
Something interesting happens everywhere. Today's new subscriber is Andy K, and he is from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hey, have you ever been hit by a meteorite? Me neither, but listen to this story. The Tale of the Hodges Meteor. It wasn't particularly large or interesting in shape, but it went down in history when it crashed through an Alabama woman's home and hit her while she was napping. Imagine that. It was the early afternoon of November 30th, 1954. And Ann Hodges had just settled into a nap on her couch when a meteorite shot through her roof. It bounced off her most likely sweet-ass wooden radio cabinet and then hit her in the side, leaving a bruise as her only injury. So how about that, huh? Ann Hodges, the only human being ever known to have been struck by a meteorite. Gosh, something interesting happens everywhere. Now, it can be a big deal to own your own meteorite. So the ownership over the piece that hit Miss Hodges quickly became a contentious matter. See, Anne and Eugene were only renters. Their landlady, a recently widowed woman named Birdie Guy, old Birdie Guy, wanted the meteorite for herself. She thought it was hers since it had crashed through her roof. She obtained a lawyer and sued, and the laws over meteorite ownership were actually on her side. But the public was pissed. She wound up settling out of court and giving up her claim to the meteorite in exchange for $500. Anne's husband, Eugene, was convinced that they could make a lot of money off the rock and turned down their first offer from the Smithsonian Museum. Because of the incident, a great deal of unwanted fame came to Anne Hodges, and she ultimately donated the meteorite to the Natural History Museum in Alabama in 1956, where it is still on display. She later suffered a nervous breakdown, the kind of thing that happens to people who get hit by meteorites, and she died in 1972. But in almost the exact same location, right outside of Tuscaloosa, there is something known as Gravity Hill, and is one of the area's most well-known attractions. And what happens is, you see, when a driver arrives at a stop sign and puts their vehicle in neutral, it is mysteriously pulled uphill. Now, many people believe the Gravity Hill is just some kind of optical illusion, but others believe there is something else behind this strange phenomenon. According to local folklore, Gravity Hill is the site of a Native American burial ground. And many believe that the reason why vehicles roll uphill is because the ghosts of these Native Americans are trying to push trespassers out of their land. Others still believe it is the ghost of a man named Henry, and he actually pushes your car uphill with ghost strength. For that reason, some refer to the spot as Henry Hill, like the main character from Goodfellas. But how about this? Another theory? It's actually another meteorite with a strong magnetic force that's buried under the site. Which theory do you like best?
New subscriber geography trivia.